I'm Jim Brandt, and this is session four of the session I'm doing this week, entitled Conversations with Fellow Travelers. And today, our figure is James Carroll, who is a novelist. And I have to confess, I know very little about James Carroll. What I know is mostly what I've seen from the video. Has anyone read any of his novels or know much about him?
Well, I just picked up a book in the bookstore by A. James Carroll.
Okay.
And there it was said that he was a priest.
I think this or James Carroll's a former priest.
A former priest. Yeah.
Okay. That's the same one.
Okay. Uh-huh.
What's the book you got? Do you know?
Oh, geez, I don't remember.
Okay. Okay.
It was one of those that was on sale in the front.
Uh-huh. Well, there are several people who've spoken to me this week and said James Carroll, they wanted to come. I don't think they got here, but knew of his work and think highly of it. The orientation that I've been taking in what we've been doing has been to focus on the idea of conversation, having conversations with others about our lives and listening to these figures like James Carroll today, listening to each other, and then also listening to ourselves. Someone who attended one of the early sessions, and she came out and she said, "Oh, that was really interesting, and the figures that you're studying this week, they're really giants and she was really kind of in awe of these people that we're encountering this week, Augustine and the saint and Julian of Norwich, the mystic, and now Frederick Buechner last night, James Carroll today, and then tomorrow Maya Angelou. She was really in awe of this lineup of people, and I appreciated that in one way because I think I'm in awe of them too, and they have profound things to say. I was also, I've got to admit, a little disconcerted by what she said, because one of the things that I want to affirm is that all of our stories are sacred. And there is, of course, pain and tragedy, but also grace and joy to be found in all of our stories. And so, while I do think these folks are giants, I also want us to remember that they're folks, just like us. And they may have some special gifts, but we all have special gifts. And each of our journeys is important, and each of our stories is sacred, and each of our stories has known grace along the way. Experienced that in a similar way. Heidi, you're here now, so I'm going to talk about you for a minute. One of the things that's really been fun for me in recent months is that I've been worshiping at the church where my spouse is the pastor. And that's really fun because, among other things, she's one of the best preachers I know. And so I really appreciate hearing her from the pulpit. And one of the things that Heidi does in her preaching is tells a lot of stories and little anecdotes about her family. And in fact, when I've preached, I've on occasion borrowed a story or two about her family. there's a little one about her, her two grandfathers, and each one had kind of a saying that he liked to use in the morning. And Heidi's one grandfather said, "If you in the morning throw minutes away, you can't pick them up in the course of the day." You know, so it's like, get up, get going, and get to work. And her other grandfather said, Heidi, what did he say? He said,
"It's nice to get up in the morning when the sun is overhead. It's nice to get up in the morning, but it's nicer to stay in bed."
Right. Well, and Heidi is always quick to remind me that it was the Presbyterian grandfather who said it was nicer to stay in bed, and it was the Lutheran who said, you know, get up and don't throw your minutes away. But that, you know, that little anecdote is such a glimpse into the personalities of Heidi's grandfathers and how they shaped the families in which they were fathers and then grandfathers, and now the great-grandchildren are around. And when Heidi has preached, often there have been parishioners who've come out and say, "Oh, your family is just so interesting and so unusual." Again, it's true. It's a really interesting family, and it is a family that knows how to tell the stories. And some of our families aren't as good at that, as good at remembering and talking about our families and hearing the stories. But, and I think this is what Heidi tried to say to the person, your family is just as unusual and interesting, and there's as much life in your family's story, whether you know it or not, and whether you're really a family that can tell it. So I really, I hope that as we look at these tapes, and as we've heard about the other people, you'll think about these folks as fellow travelers, and they are articulate people who can really tell a story well. But their story, I believe that their story is no more profound than your story. So I want to encourage you to celebrate your own story. What I'd like to do now this morning is listen to the tape. The title of the whole tape is Sacred Stories, and it's got Frederick Buechner, Maya Angelou, and today James Carroll. It was done by the Trinity Institute in 1990 in New York City. And the information about the tape is about how you might get it if you're interested in it is on there, and I'd be glad to give that to anybody after the session. But for now, I hope, can you all see okay? We should be able to have both TVs on again like we did last night.
In part two of Sacred Stories, novelist James Carroll, author of 8 works of fiction, including Prince of Peace, offers another story of a father and son. By remembering his relationship with his own father in the past, Carroll redefines that relationship for the present. Memory for him becomes a valuable vehicle which shapes his personal identity.
My mother is named Mary. She believes in God. Every night when she goes to bed, she says a rosary, one decade each, for each of her sons, Joe and Jim and Brian and Dennis and Kevin. She goes to Mass on weekends. She kneels for communion, though a vein swells in her knee, and she is generally fond of priests. She is Irish, and her life takes its meaning from the religion of her people. When my mother held me those years ago, part of what she held me with was God. I had the usual memories of rocking the old chair against her breast, the breathing, the humming, the mother smell. Because my mother quite openly talked to Mary, the mother of God, as if they were sisters of the same woman, not piously, but Holy Mary, or Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. I associated my belief from an early age with my love for that woman. And not only love, of course, but fear. I learned how to fear God by fearing her. Cross my mother, I learned, and you cross God's mother. It was the secret of her power. But have her embrace in the very heart of the universe was yours. I learned faith in the cradle of her arms. It was as strong and sure as she was. God was as affectionate and as impatient. Jesus was one of the boys, and he was as subject to the conspiracy of mothers of Mary's as I was. Remembering my mother's embrace, seeing her now rocking in the old chair, I realize why Jesus chose the word Abba to describe the experience he has of communion with all that exists. He applies the word to God, but incarnation means he learned what he knew of God, even what of God he was in himself, from and with and through the men and women who shared his time and place. I see him in the cradle of a woman's arms, as an infant and as a dead man. And I understand the motherhood, fatherhood that gave him life, even through death. My father's name is Joseph. He reached the peak of his life as an Air Force general, a powerful, accomplished, dedicated man whose idealism and commitment took shape in a world of intrigue and barely balanced terror that was just ending when I grew up. He was the founding director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. There were regular crises in those years with the Soviet Union, and what brought them home, literally, to us, was the red phone that was waiting on the table by my parents' bed, waiting to ring with an announcement of World War III. It was part of the emergency telephone network that linked the White House with the military leadership. And I recall that it was very clear to me that only two reasons could justify that phone ringing. One would be the imminent possibility of war. The other, the occasional test of the system. Several times, that red phone rang while we were at dinner. And when that happened, a dread stillness would settle over the table while my father left the room to answer. Always prepared for the worst, that's true of me still, I expected disaster. I expected my dad to rush from the house, kissing us all briefly. But what I remember most about that awful stillness in which I tormented myself with fears was my mother's breaking in by saying, "Eat your potatoes, Jim. Elbow off the table, Kevin. Pass the butter, Joe." Saying, in effect, "Look, the only thing to do in a moment like this is to eat, live, be alive." As it turned out, the phone was only being tested when it rang in my presence. Once, when I was gone, it rang for real, and my father was off to the Cuban Missile Crisis. He disappeared for more than a week. Even then, even if the war had come, I can imagine my mother saying, Eat. It is more important now than ever. Pass the food. I imagine my mother insisting on life even in the face of that death. Ordinary, calm, kindly life. Stern with death. Life itself is the last refuge from panic, the final defeat of horror. Eat, especially now, even now. I know that remembering is about accepting. We can accept experience and memory in a way that we can't accept it when we're undergoing it. It's a function of the coming to terms with that we do when we remember. There was a phone like that in my father's car. And often, late at night, I would drive him home in that car from the Pentagon. I remember my father looking out the window at the lights of Washington while I watched his reflection in the corner of the big wraparound windshield of that Air Force blue limousine. One of these nights, he said, I might not come home. I listened, pushed back the ocean down the well of my throat, knowing, of course, what he meant. And if that happens, my father was saying, I won't even be able to call, maybe. So it'll be up to you and Joe. Just get Mom and the boys and go. It was the only time he'd ever spoken that way, and he never would again. My father didn't say where to go or how to get there. No gas, no time. I knew there would be no place, certainly not from Washington, which was ground zero. But it didn't matter. My father wasn't talking about the escape of the family at all. He was simply weighed down by the dread fatalism common to war planners of the era. And he was really just saying that he was my father and that I was his son. It was a union and a bond fashioned mainly of silence and shared fear and love of the family and the strange intimacy of a nighttime drive that nothing could ever break. We would be father and son forever. Not even World War III would separate us. But who would have guessed? A lousy little war in the swollen finger of Southeast Asia came out of nowhere then and almost did. I thought that if I disagreed with my father, it would kill me. I had begun that decade imitating him, serving as an ROTC cadet. I thought that if I disapproved of the project to which he was giving the best years of his life then, through the late 60s, it would kill him. Eventually, though, I learned that my father's sense of his own integrity did not depend on my approval. Although as the war in Vietnam escalated into a true American crime, my disapproval grew to horror and anger and shame. My father survived, and so did I. One of my brothers, Dennis, was much more forthright than I in challenging the war in Vietnam. Because of age and circumstance, he was subject to the draft, and when the moment of choice arrived, he became a resisting conscientious objector. At first, my father was shocked and hurt. My brother was living at home at the time, homeless, on Bolling Air Force Base in Washington. There was an ongoing agony of silence and argument between them. There was an escalation that seemed to match every escalation of the war. Dennis, when he applied for conscientious objector status, was turned down by the draft board. And when he appealed, he was turned down again. Finally, there came the moment of his last appeal. If he were rejected again, he'd have to decide whether to leave the country, join the underground, or violate his conscience and serve in the army. It was a moment when the bond of our whole family was pushed to the breaking point. Dennis was informed that for the final appeal, he could appear in the company of his lawyer. Well, before becoming a general, my father had been a lawyer. And Dennis asked him to come with him. My father went, general's uniform and all. He argued on his son's behalf, and CO status was granted. It is a matter of our learning from our own upbringing and from our own parenthood, from our sonship and daughterhood. Life works, if we let it, to free us from a primitive, Oedipal piety. In our own lives and in our faith, we need not choose between a passive, rejected, and therefore approved son, and a crucified but perversely forgiving father. Instead, we can see them, father and son, as we are to our own parents, two acts of integrity in relation to each other. Where there is abandonment, it is mutual, a consequence of two freedoms at work on each other. And where there is forgiveness and repossession, it goes both ways. As Jesus puts it in his prayer, and all parents and grown children can say this to each other, I have glorified you. It is time for you to glorify me. When my brother Dennis told me that he was going to ask my father to defend him, I thought my brother was crazy. And more than that, I thought my brother would, that it would be the occasion of a final rupture that would really destroy our family. I was very opposed to it. And it was only later that I realized what a profound act of trust my brother was making in my father. And I think that to be trusted in that way is, for most people, for my father it was, irresistible. And so what happened then, of course, is the father is changed by the child. And what we believe as Christians is that in Jesus the father is changed by the child, which is, I think, the central note of our redemption, that Jesus changes the father for everybody. And it's a dynamic that every family has to play out one way or another. So fathers with their salt are always ready to be changed by their children.
Remembering is an important part, I think, of spiritual growth, because if I'm right in this general thing I keep saying, that God speaks to us most eloquently, most powerfully, most irresistibly through what happens to us, and we forget what's happened to us, we've forgotten the words that have been spoken to us from on high. I think that's the most important part of memory. Just the way Scripture remembers and remembers and remembers the captivity and the exodus and the promised land and the coming and the death and the resurrection, never losing track of these mighty acts of God. And we all in our lives have these less mighty, because they don't get the headlines, but for us, equally mighty acts of God, our own captivities, our own exoduses, our own discovery of something like the promised land, and our own deaths and resurrections. These are, that's the highest of the Shikta, that is our own sacred history. And to lose track of this, to lose track of the most precious thing you have.
My impulse to tell the story of my father as a powerful general and the father of a war-resisting son and the crisis of the family that led to really is as simple as making sure that my own children know where they come from. And my impulse to, for example, let this personal story of my own families be the basis of a novel, the impulse comes from wanting to make sure that my children, 7-year-old Patrick and 10-year-old Elizabeth, know who they come from, who they're connected to. And as a
Christian, I immediately recognized in this impulse what Jesus is dealing with when he talked about the Abba, because he's talking there about the connection that he intuits with God.
Let's talk together a little bit about the video, about what Carol had to say. And I'd like it if you'd share any questions, either clarification or substance, or any insights you had as you saw that video and thought about it.
Did he say whether, or do you know whether he resisted the war himself? Because he went in the priesthood, so maybe he was exempt.
Yeah, and I think he was older.
He was too old for the draft.
And he said, he did say he was less vocal than his younger brother in his opposition to the war.
He also said he went through ROTC, so he was certainly involved early on to a degree. But I think the priestly thing came in there. It was the priest during that time.
I guess I've been doing a lot of thinking lately about this whole concept that our image of God and our relationship with God is so shaped by our parents. In a sense, God really took a great risk that he would let that be the forming ground of that relationship, because when you look at it, when I look at my relationship to my parents, what it was, and I look at other people, I mean, there's so many dysfunctional families that the relationship to God is going to be pretty dysfunctional. Mm-hmm. And how does that get healed, you know? And I don't know, that whole thing just...
Where that's scariest to me is to think about myself as a parent.
I know.
And then to think about the way in which I shape my kids and their...
Which brings a lot of guilt, too. Mm-hmm. I think I've experienced a lot of guilt in the last year or two about my inadequacies as a father now that my fathering role is over with, really. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and what I do with that, and asking for forgiveness for my boys and so on. And I think about that, that I look at them kind of wandering away, really, from God right now. At least outwardly. I don't know what they're doing inside. And that's a little scary. And then I wonder what kind of responsibility did I have for where they're at today. And you know, you could just drive yourself crazy with this stuff and ultimately just have to let it go, and God's got to take care of it, because you know, we can't be perfect.
Yeah.
But I think that's a scary thing, which I'm glad I didn't know when I started out parenting. Because I probably wouldn't have been a parent. I mean, we got to be young and foolish to have kids, I think, almost. And God probably built us that way. Because
as a grandparent, you'll be able to make all the corrections and take a second stab at the grandchildren.
Yeah.
That's the purpose of grandparents, isn't it? To save the parent, the children yeah. from their parents?
Yeah.
I actually think I enjoyed my grandparent days. Enjoy, you know, my grandparent days more than I did my parenting days.
Sure.
And that's almost...
You can give them back.
That's almost a nice thing to say. But you do shed a lot of that responsibility and just retain all the joys.
And that's sort of like the bumper sticker, if I had known grandchildren were so much fun, I'd have had them first.
Yeah.
Excellent.
I'm just really, I wonder what, and you talked a little bit early in the tape about, you know, the scene at their dinner table and stuff, and you wonder, I think in order for the, is it Dennis, the son's name? To risk asking his father to represent him as counsel, there had to be some pretty pretty substantial trust level already.
I didn't even think of that as being risk. He knew his father. Mm-hmm.
But he also knew the military, or should have taken into account the military, how his father really puts his career on the line doing that.
Sure, he knew that too, but he knew his father.
But James didn't, apparently, from, you know, yeah, James was really nervous.
Well, he's
thinking.
The one that's, he's the kind of floppy one, isn't he? If he was a priest and he's not now, he's kind of waffly. He didn't know his father-in-law. I was wondering about it. There were an awful lot of kids, sons of Congress people and military people who had sons and daughters resisting.
But also the ability of the father to differentiate himself from his son and not need to have, I mean, to be able to allow his son to be his own person, and to defend his right to be his own person even though it was so contrary to who he was, I think it's kind of extraordinary.
It strikes me that the tremendous boundaries, beautiful boundaries that they had set, so his father wasn't really living through his son, which is so often the case, that the boundaries, there's so much enmeshment there.
That's right.
And that he could be that secure himself to be able to defend his son with something that goes against what he is living as a person is to me, is phenomenal. I don't see a lot of that where parents are able to let go that much and have that clear boundary that they're not, you know, trying to live through their kids in some way, which is really kind of an exciting prospect.
I think and vice versa too, where kids often can be protective of their parents and in a way live through their parents. And again, Dennis seemed to get that, but James, one of the notes I have written down here was James saying that he thought at one period, if I disagreed with Father, it would kill me. And then later, if I disagreed with Father, it would kill him. So James did not have that sense of boundary originally and was sort of tied up with his father.
James Dennis. Is the oldest.
Yeah, but that's what I was going to say. Does that make a difference?
Did he say,
or he's the second oldest? Because there's a Joe who's
Joseph. By inference from there, I took Joseph to be younger. Maybe the third of the children.
Because it was James he gave the instructions to.
And James was the one that drove his daughter.
Where would you go with that in terms of James being the oldest and what significance that might have?
He starts being responsible for his dad's actions all the time.
And it's harder for him to differentiate from his father than it is for the younger brothers.
Son said something better.
It's raining.
I think deep to me the other day. I've been really going way past the boundaries of what a father ought to do in terms of suggesting rather than nagging. But he's got a mole on his nose that's discolored a little and it's been bleeding, and we've read some things about skin cancer. And it really is scary. And he won't go to the doctor. And he lost a good buddy. He's my son's a newspaper editor and reporter, and he lost a good friend who had stomach cancer and treated it with over-the-counter medication too long. And Scott really grieved with this guy, and now Scott is doing the same. I don't think it's the same thing, but I've checked enough doctors to say it doesn't sound like it is cancerous, but he certainly ought to have a check. And you're right in pushing him. So the other night, I couldn't sleep, and Scott works night shift, and sometimes I'll call him because usually around 11 o'clock they got the paper to bed and talk a little. So I call him, oh, hi, Ed. And I said, I'm thinking about your mole again. He said, oh my God, so are you still? And I said, yeah, I can't sleep, I just got to tell you. And he got really mad, and madder than he's ever gotten. And we, one problem we had, we never learned to really fight well. We didn't have reasons to. Maybe the easiest kid can imagine to raise, and maybe it was just too picture perfect, or we thought it was. And so he got really mad, and he says, "God damn it, Dad," he says, "I'm 43 years old, you're treating me like a 3-year-old, and I restrain myself from saying that you're acting like it." And he says,
"Good for you."
He pulled back and says, "You know, Dad, when you push this hard, I'm going to get mad." And he says, "It's necessary for me to get mad. It's necessary for me to get mad." And I didn't have a chance, I think he hung up. I didn't have a chance to ask him what he meant by that. So I'm going back to face the same thing, because he's told us now, his mother and I, he's not going to have this looked at until he's moved. And they've just been moving, process of moving since at Bristol. But he's crazy. He's got 4 kids and he's paralyzed, I think, with fear. And the point is, and I've gotten enough medical knowledge that the chances are pretty good that it's not a melanoma, a serious thing, but could, you know, it should be checked, and I'm a worrier. But the point is that he could say to me, "It's necessary for me to get mad at you. It's necessary," and not just like, "It's necessary." Back in town, it's not necessary for me to be mad at you. But I had a hard time getting mad at him because my father was so abusive that I couldn't. I went the other way with my kids. But, you know, I think that's the trust level that he can. God damn it, mind your own business.
Maybe if he gets angry enough, you can go and have a check.
Yeah. You know, wife doesn't dare tell him. Bulldozes, you know, he's got this manipulative thing about his anger. But anyway, he's a stubborn guy.
Yeah, you're saying that, Bob, makes me think that the next section of the video goes back to Frederick Buechner, and it's him dealing with an issue as a parent dealing with one of his children. Similar to yours, but even more dramatic in a way. And one option for us now might be to... Would you like to see that?
How long is it?
It's another 20 minutes. So it would take most of our time. We wouldn't have a lot of time to discuss it, but I think it kind of moves further in the direction that we've been talking about, relationship of... We've been talking more about the relationship of child to parent, looking at it from the child's point of view. Now, this would move us more towards parent, towards children, and looking at the issues which several of us have raised. Should we do that?
Mm-hmm. Save it for me. I'm going to catch it. I got to go with Pam.
Okay.
Pam,
okay.
Hudson, Pam.
It's here. Detail. It's here. And if you grab me, you could certainly look at it.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell me to.
Tell me when something comes on.
Okay.
I keep talking about the dark things we have to remember, because somehow they're easier to talk about. And because maybe they're the things we're most apt to keep secret. In part 3 of Sacred Stories, author Frederick Buechner continues his journey into the past. In this poignant story of his teenage daughter, Buechner discovers the presence of God during a dark and confusing time. This discovery reveals his own need for spiritual healing, demonstrating the importance of memory and restoring a person to wholeness.
There are 2 pieces of stained glass that sit propped up in one of the windows in the room where I used to write. One of those pieces of stained glass, which I think I asked somebody to give me one Christmas, chose the cowardly lion from the Wizard of Oz, with his feet bound with rope and his face streaming with tears, as a few of the winged monkeys who have bound him hover around him in the background. The other piece of stained glass is a diptych that somebody gave me once, and it always causes me a twinge of embarrassment when I notice it, because it seems a little too complacently religious. On one of its panels are written the words, "May the blessing of God crown this house," and on the other, "Fortunate is he whose work is blessed and whose household is prospered by the Lord." The cowardly lion is me, of course, crying, tied up, afraid. I'm crying because at the time I'm speaking of, some 15 years ago, a lot of sad and scary things were going on in our house that I felt helpless either to understand or do anything about. Yet, despite its rather self-satisfied religiosity, I believe the diptych was telling the truth about that time, too. I believe the blessing of God was indeed crowning our house, even then, in the sense that the sad and scary things themselves, as it turned out, were a fearsome blessing. And all the time those things were happening, the very fact that I was able to save my sanity by continuing to write, among other things, a novel called Godric, made my work blessed and a means of grace, at least for me. Because nothing I've ever written came out of a darker time or brought me more light and comfort. What happened was that one of our daughters began to stop eating. There was nothing scary about it at first. It was just the sort of thing any girl who thought she'd be prettier if she lost a few pounds might do. Nothing for breakfast, maybe a carrot or a Diet Coke for lunch. For supper, maybe a little salad with low-calorie dressing. But then, as the months went by, it became very scary. Anorexia nervosa is the name of the sickness she was suffering from, needless to say. And the best understanding that I've been able to arrive at goes something like this. Young people, especially, crave to be free and independent. They crave also to be taken care of and safe. And the dark magic of anorexia is that it satisfies both of these cravings at once. By not eating, you take your stand against the world that is telling you what to do and what to be. And by not eating, you also make your body so much smaller and lighter and weaker that in effect it becomes a child's body again. And the world flocks to your rescue. This double victory is so great that not even self-destruction apparently seems too high a price to pay for it. Be that as it may, she got more thin and more thin, till she began to have this skull-like face and fleshless arms and legs of a victim of Buchenwald. And at the same time, the cowardly lion got more afraid and sad, felt more and more helpless. No rational argument, no dire medical warning, no pleading or cajolery or bribery would make this young woman he loved eat again, but only seemed to strengthen her determination not to eat. This young woman, on whose life his own life in so many ways depended. He could not solve her problem, because like any father, he was of course himself so much a part of her problem. And then finally, when she had to be hospitalized, a doctor called from far away, where she was one morning, to say that unless they started feeding her against her will, she would die. It was as clear cut as that. Tears ran down the cowardly lion's face as he stood with a telephone to his ears. His paws were tied. The bat-winged monkeys uttered. I was convinced we start off with the mark of God's thumb upon us somehow. I tried to say that in one of the lectures, whatever it means to say we're made in the image of God. There is this holy place inside ourselves which gets all sorts of abuse and battering and knocking about and so on. And a lot of, I think, what we're all of us trying to do, or from time to time trying to do, is get back down into that holy place and listen to the intuitions and the wisdom and the sources of healing that are inside of us. And I think in some people the process becomes so sort of covered over that it's hard to know. But I think a lot of people would know what I'm talking about when I talk about that. My anorectic daughter was in danger of starving to death, and without knowing it, so was I. I wasn't living my own life anymore, because I was so caught up in hers. In refusing to eat, she was mad as a hatter. I was, if anything, madder still. Because whereas in some sense she knew what she was doing to herself, as far as what I was doing to myself was concerned, I knew nothing. Nothing at all. She had given up food. I had virtually given up doing anything in the way of feeding myself humanly. To be at peace is to have peace inside yourself, more or less in spite of what's going on outside yourself. In that sense, I had no peace at all. If on one particular day she took it into her head to have a slice of toast, say, with her dietetic supper, I was in heaven. If on some other day she decided to have no supper at all, I was in hell. I choose those terms with care and theologically. Hell is where there is no light, but only dark. And I was so caught up in my fear for her life, which had become a way of my life, that none of the usual sources of light worked anymore. And that was what I was starving for, light, and life was what I was starving for. I had the companionship of my wife, my other two children, I read books, I played tennis, walked the woods, I saw friends, I went to movies. But even in the midst of such times as that, I remained so locked inside myself that I was not really present in those times at all. Toward the end of C.S. Lewis's Narnia book, The Last Battle, there's a scene where a group of dwarves sit huddled together in a tight little knot, thinking that they are in a pitch black, stinking stable, when the truth of it is that they are out in the midst of an endless grassy countryside as green as Vermont, with the sun shining and the blue sky overhead. The huge golden lion Aslan himself stands nearby, with all the other dwarves kneeling in a circle around his forepaws, as Lewis writes, and burying their hands and faces in his mane as he stooped his great head to touch them with his tongue. When Aslan offers the cringing little knot of dwarves food, they think it is awful. When he offers them wine, they think it is ditch water. Perfect love casteth out fear, John writes. And the other side of that is that fear, like mine, casteth out love, Even God's love, the love I had for my daughter, was lost in the dark stable of the anxiety I had for my daughter. The only way I knew to be a father was to take care of her, to move heaven and earth if necessary, to make her well. And of course I couldn't do that. I didn't have either the wisdom or the power to make her well. None of us has the power. None of us has the power to change other human beings like that, thank God. Because it would be a terrible power if we did. The power to violate the humanity of other people, even for their own good. The psychiatrist we consulted told me I couldn't cure her. The best thing I could do for her was to stop trying to do anything. I think in my heart I knew they were right. But it didn't stop the madness of my desperate meddling. Everything I could think to do or say only stiffened her resolve to be free from, among other things, me. Her not eating was a symbolic way of striking out for that freedom. The only way she would ever be well again was if and when she freely chose to be well again. The best I could do as her father was to stand back and give her that freedom at the risk of her using it to choose even for death instead of life. Fathers and mothers, give ear. Love your neighbor as yourself is part of the great commandment. The other way to say it is love yourself as your neighbor. Love yourself not in some egocentric, self-serving sense, but love yourself the way you love your friend, in the sense of taking care of yourself, nourishing yourself, trying to understand, trying to comfort, trying to strengthen yourself.
Plain to all of our stories, even though we might not all use those theological words to describe it, have to do with sin and grace, with sin as the experience of estrangement, basically, from other people, even ones we love, from ourselves, from God, if we believe in God, or from the way things are, if that's all we have. We all go through that, these shadow times, and yet at the same time we all have experiences of grace.
How easy it is to write, to speak to you. Such words. And how hard it was to live. What saved the day for my daughter was that when she finally had to be hospitalized in order to keep her alive, it happened about 3,000 miles away from me. I was not there to protect her, to make her decisions, to manipulate events on her behalf. And the result was that she had to face those events in her own. There was no one to shield her from those events and their consequences in all their inexorability. In the form of doctors, nurses, social workers, the judge who determined that she was a danger to her own life and thus could be legally hospitalized against her will, in the form of those people, society stepped in. Those men and women were not haggard, dithering, lovesick, as I was. They were realistic, tough, conscientious, and in those ways, though they would never put it in such terms themselves, they loved her. They loved her in the sense that I believe is closer to what Jesus meant by love than what I have been doing. God loves in something like their way, I think. The doctors, the nurses, the judge, the social workers. The power that created the universe and spun the dragonfly's wing and is beyond all other powers holds back in love from overpowering us. I've never felt God's presence more strongly than when my wife and I visited that distant hospital where our daughter was, walking down the sterile hospital corridor to the room that had her name taped to the door, I felt that presence surrounding me like air, like air. God, in his very stillness, holding his breath, loving her, loving us, the only way I think he can without destroying us. One night we went to Compline in an Episcopal cathedral, and in the coolness and near emptiness of that great stone vaulted place, in the remoteness of the choir's voices chanting, I felt again the passionate restraint and hush of God. Little by little, the young woman I loved began to get well. Emerging out of the shadows, finally as strong and sane and wise and funny and crazy as anybody I know on this earth, even if she weren't my daughter. And little by little, as I watched her healing happen, I began to see how much I was in need of healing and getting well myself. Like Lewis's dwarves, for a long time I had sat huddled in the dark of a stable of my own making. It was only now that I started to suspect the presence of the green countryside, the golden lion in whose image and likeness even cowardly lions are made.
Well, you could look for God in many different places, I suppose. You can look for him in pages of scripture, you can look for him in the service of the church, you can look for him in the actions of the people whom you love and who love you. Indeed, lots of different places. To me, in my own experience, the place where, if indeed there is a God who speaks, the place where I've heard him speak most eloquently and most almost undeniably is in things that have happened to me.
I found myself feeling quite joyful, even as Frederick Buechner described the, with great poignancy, the agony of his own depression. And even as he described that most awful experience, it was impossible to listen to it without feeling relief, without feeling enabled, commissioned really, to admit the presence in my own heart of a similar place, and to feel this, feel gratefully this connection with another person.
It is in losing, I suppose, that one gains everything. It's when I'm leaning on a table or leaning against the wall, when the wall is removed, I have myself entirely. So if I lose a thing, the one thing I know I can't lose is the proximity, the presence and the accessibility of God. That I can't lose.
To remember those dark times, that the sort of the sad parts, the hurtful parts of our past, is a way of, I said, blessing the past, by which I mean you look back at something that seemed to you a cursed time in your past. The awful defeat, the terrible disappointment, the death, the loss, which seemed a defeat, which seemed to separate you from God. You were unaware, if God is God, how can these things happen? But to look back at them discerningly sort of
optimally, imaginatively, is to see, I think, again and again, without wanting to sound like Pollyanna, that through even that darkness, there was a kind of new understanding, if only now, a kind of new possibility of growth, if not then, at least now. Okay.